Imagine walking into like the main vault of a massive Wall Street institution.
Okay.
You know, you expect to see gold bars and these immaculately organized ledgers and just impenetrable
Right,
security.
the whole movie set up.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, it's just this room full of people in expensive suits, and they're frantically writing down like billion-dollar IOUs on sticky notes
Oh, God.
and then just immediately throwing them into a ceiling fan.
That's horrifying.
Right. But that chaotic image, that is exactly what the global financial system would look like without the incredibly rigid, unforgiving framework of books and
They
records.
really would be.
And that is exactly what we're mastering today. But real quick before we get into it, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Yeah.
If you're prepping for your exams, they've got a full series 99 course with, you know, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. So check it out at certfuel.com.
Definitely worth checking out.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's unpack this. Today we are staring down the absolute beast of the FANRA Series 99 exam.
The big one.
We're talking about function one.
Which, I mean, just to put the sheer gravity of this into perspective right out of the gate, this represents 70% of the exam.
Wait, 70?
70%. Yeah. There are 35 scored items focused entirely on this operational framework.
Wow.
So if you are going to pass this test, this is the mountain you have to climb. It's the core of the entire credential.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of people hear the phrase books and records and they immediately just glaze
Oh,
over.
for sure.
You think of, I don't know, filing cabinets and dust and just administrative busy work.
Yeah, like you're stuck in a basement somewhere.
Right. But we need to reframe that mindset immediately because you aren't going to conquer a 70% exam beast by just trying to brute force memorize like a dictionary of rules.
No, that won't work.
You conquer it by understanding the actual underlying architecture of a broker dealer.
Exactly. Because this framework, I mean, it is the absolute bedrock of the firm. It is the only way a broker dealer can objectively prove its financial condition
Right.
or, track its customer activity and secure its positions. Without an unshakable record-keeping framework, a financial institution is just this giant black box of liability.
Yeah.
The records are the reality. If it isn't documented correctly, then as far as the regulators are concerned, well, it didn't happen.
Or worse, it happened illegally.
Exactly.
I like to look at the broker-dealer as like a highly active, constantly evolving crime scene.
Oh, I like that.
And I mean that in the most, you know, professional analytical way possible. But the records that we are dissecting today, they are the forensic evidence.
Right.
They're the DNA swabs, they're the muddy footprints in the hallway, the timestamp security footage.
Yeah, the proof.
And if that footage is blurry, or, you know, if those footprints are swept up before the investigator even arrives, regulatory authorities like the SEC and FINRA, they don't just give you the benefit of the
Oh,
doubt.
no, never.
They assume the firm is just guilty of systemic chaos.
That is the perfect way to look at it, really, because a regulator's default stance is always just prove it.
Prove it.
Right. You claim you have a million shares of a particular stock in custody. Prove it.
Right.
You claim your net capital meets the statutory requirement. Well, prove it. And you cannot prove it if your forensic evidence is contaminated.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the operations personnel, the folks taking the Series 99, their fundamental mandate is to transform every single cash movement, every security transfer, every account update into a reliable, verifiable audit trail.
Because that trail is the literal mechanism of customer protection.
Exactly.
Okay, so to establish that trail, to capture that security footage perfectly, you first have to know exactly when the cameras are supposed to be rolling,
Right.
which means we need to talk about the timeline of posting.
This is huge.
And to make these rules really stick, because I know I need examples for things to stick in my brain, we are going to rely on a few hypothetical friends throughout this deep dive.
Good idea.
Let's introduce Broker Bob.
Oh, Broker Bob.
Right. So Bob is a well-meaning professional, but he is fundamentally disorganized. He's perpetually looking for an operational shortcut.
Basically, my worst nightmare is a compliance officer.
Exactly. He's the guy with coffee stains on the ledgers, and he firmly believes that close enough is good enough.
Which is an actively dangerous mindset in an operations department. Bob is just a walking regulatory violation waiting to happen.
Precisely. And Bob has a client, and we'll call him Customer Carl.
Okay, customer Carl.
Now, Carl is highly eccentric. Carl doesn't just buy, you know, standard index funds.
Of course not.
No, Carl likes to buy massive, weird volumes of highly obscure stocks at strange hours, which is constantly testing Bob's ability to keep the book straight.
That's a bad combo, Bob and Carl.
A terrible combo. So let's say Carl calls Bob on a Tuesday morning and urgently wants to buy 413 shares of a deeply illiquid microcap company that, I don't know, manufactures left-handed spatulas.
As one does.
Right. So Bob executes the trade. Where does the DNA of this transaction go first? Where is the very first place it gets written down?
It goes directly into the blotter,
It's all blotter.
specifically the daily blotter. In the FINRA regulatory world, the blotter is defined as the daily record of original entry.
Okay.
It is the frontline document. It captures purchases, sales, securities movements, cash movements, and, other debits and credits as they happen. And the most critical operative word in that whole definition is daily.
Daily. So I think of the blotter kind of like a hyper-accurate time-stamped ship's log,
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
or like a high school gossip diary. Right. It has to be written that exact day, right, as the activity occurs.
Exactly.
Like if Carl buys his spatula stock on Tuesday, Bob has to log it in the Tuesday blotter. You can't just wait until Friday to write down what happened on Tuesday
No, you absolutely cannot.
because the market moves too fast. By Friday, the reality of the firm's risk exposure has completely changed. So the blotter is the raw, unedited daily reality.
And this is exactly where we need to look at the why behind the rule.
Yeah, why daily?
Because financial markets involve intraday risk, margin calls, and just rapid fluctuations in asset value.
Right.
If a firm is allowing trades to just sort of pile up on a desk to be entered, whenever there's time, the firm has no idea what its actual exposure is at any given moment.
Which is terrifying.
Right. That is how firms collapse overnight. They don't realize they're over-leveraged until it's way too late. The daily blotter ensures real-time operational awareness.
Okay, so if the blotter is capturing every single micro movement every single day, what is the point of the other financial documents?
Which ones?
Well, I'm looking at the trial balance and the capital computation.
Okay.
Because if Bob is diligently filling out his daily ship's log, why is he doing extra math at the end of the month? Like, isn't that totally redundant?
Well, it might seem redundant to Bob.
Everything seems redundant to Bob.
Right. But they serve entirely distinct regulatory purposes. The daily blotter is about transaction logging. The trial balance and capital computation are about solvency proving.
Oh, okay. Transaction logging versus solvency proving.
Exactly. The rules require firms to prepare a trial balance and a capital computation at least monthly. The trial balance exists to prove the money balances of the ledger accounts. It is a structural mathematical check on the system.
Okay, wait. Explain the capital computation part because that sounds incredibly important, like keeping the doors open important.
It is literally the difference between life and death for a broker-dealer.
Wow.
The capital computation is the re required aggregate indebtedness and net capital computation.
That's a mouthful.
It is. But in plain English, it proved the firm actually has enough liquid money to legally keep its doors open.
Okay.
If your net capital drops below a certain statutory threshold, the SEC can just shut you down to protect the clients. So you run the blotter daily to capture the action, but you run the trial balance and capital computation monthly to prove you are still mathematically solvent.
Okay, let me put these side by side because contrasting them really locks the concept in for me.
Let's do it.
So the blotter is the raw security footage from the camera.
Yep.
It's chaotic, it's granular, it's daily action. The trial balance is the polished, edited documentary that you release a month later.
I like that framing.
It summarizes the reality to prove a broader point.
That's perfect. And this brings us to a massive exam trap.
Oh, let's hear it.
I need everyone listening to pay very close attention to this structural trick. The exam writers know that people confuse these documents.
Because there's so many of them.
Exactly. So they will present a scenario where they ask what document captures a specific customer trade or a cash movement.
Okay.
And they will explicitly offer a monthly financial summary, like a trial balance, as a multiple choice option.
Oh, I see. Because they want to see if you'll bite on the broader financial document.
Exactly. Do not let them trick you into substituting a subsequent financial summary for the required itemized daily transaction record.
So a monthly summary is not a blotter.
Not at all. If the question is asking about an original entry or a specific daily movement, the answer is the blotter. Always.
Okay, let's put this into practice right now.
Let's do it.
Listeners, I'm going to throw a scenario at you, and I want you to literally pause and actually answer it in your head before we move on. Ready?
Go for it.
Here we go. Broker Bob processes a massive, highly complex cash movement to settle a trade for customer Carl on a Thursday afternoon. Does that specific Thursday movement get logged on the trial balance or the blotter? Take a second. Think about it.
Let them think.
Got it. It goes on the blotter.
Yes.
Because it is daily original itemized activity. The trial balance doesn't care about the specific mechanics of that Thursday afternoon movement until it is time to prove the overall aggregate math at the end of the month.
Spot on. Perfect explanation. So Bob has successfully logged Carl's eccentric microcap trade in the daily blotter. The paper trail exists.
Hooray for Bob.
Right.
Yeah.
But a paper trail is only a theory until it is verified against physical reality.
Uh-oh.
What happens when the dust settles? Bob goes to verify the assets, and the internal records do not actually match the physical assets sitting in the firm's vault or at the depository.
That is where the panic sets in. That's a bad day for Bob.
A very bad day. And that friction, that gap between the theoretical paper record and the harsh physical reality, that brings us to reconciliations.
Okay, so a reconciliation is fundamentally like a stress test of your records.
Yeah.
You're taking the firm's internal books, you know, the ledgers, the blotters, and you are comparing them with the related cash, securities, or external account records. You are actively hunting for differences.
Correct. You are trying to find exactly where the system broke down.
Let's bring Bob back in to illustrate why this goes wrong.
Or Bob.
So Bob is doing a routine reconciliation count. He goes into the vault, whether that's, you know, a physical vault or a digital depository check, and he counts exactly 1,000 shares of Carl's left-handed spatula stock.
Okay, 1,000 shares.
But Bob looks at the firm's official position record, the book that is supposed to be infallible, right?
Hmm.
And the book clearly dictates they should have 1,020 shares.
So we have a documented difference of 20 shares.
Right. And Bob, being our resident shortcut seeker, looks at this discrepancy and his brain just immediately rationalizes it.
Of course it does.
He thinks, look, this firm manages hundreds of millions of shares across thousands of accounts. We are off by 20 shares on a weird microcap stock. That's just a rounding error.
Oh, Bob.
The aggregate totals for the firm's overall equity positions are incredibly close. I'm not going to spend 5 hours tracking down 20 shares. We're good.
And this is the exact moment we introduce our third character. Compliance, Kathy.
Yes.
Kathy is the terrifyingly competent enforcer of operational rules.
She does not mess around.
She lives for the audit trail. She views the SEC rulebook not as a guideline, but as a sacred text.
I picture her carrying a clipboard everywhere she goes.
Always. And Kathy hears Bob mutter the phrase, close enough, and she is going to come down on him like a ton of bricks.
Why? Because to Bob, 20 shares is just a rounding error. But to Kathy, those 20 shares represent a fundamental failure of the firm's fiduciary duty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Kathy understands the underlying mechanism of risk. Close enough is an illusion. It routinely masks systemic failure, negligence, or even outright theft.
Oh.
Let's dig into the why here. Why can't Bob just rely on aggregate totals being close? Because netting out errors hides the victims.
Oh, wait, that's a really great point. Netting out errors hides the victims. Explain the math on that.
Sure. So if you are inexplicably up 20 shares in one client's account and you are missing 20 shares in another client's account, your firm's aggregate total looks absolutely perfect on paper.
Right, because plus 20 and minus 20 is zero.
Exactly. The net difference is zero. But underneath that perfect aggregate total, it is an operational disaster.
Oh, man.
You have overreported assets to one client, and you have literally lost the assets of another. The exam will test this concept aggressively.
So this is another major exam trap.
A massive one. A reconciliation is not satisfied merely because aggregate totals appear close.
Never.
Let me say that again to lock it in. Aggregate totals being close means absolutely nothing in regulatory compliance. You cannot net out your mistakes to pretend they don't exist.
Okay, so Kathy has thoroughly dismantled Bob's rounding error excuse.
She destroyed him.
Bob is sweating. He still can't find these 20 shares. What does Kathy force Bob to do with this discrepancy? Like, does he just leave a blank space on the ledger until he figures it out?
No, you can never just leave a void in the records. Because the missing shares haven't been resolved yet, Bob is forced to record that specific 20-share discrepancy in a highly specific holding pen.
A holding pen.
Yeah, it goes into a security count difference account for follow-up.
All right, I want you to pause whatever you're doing right now and focus on this exact phrase. I am lowering my voice right now, so you pay attention. If you are sitting in that testing center, the clock is ticking down, and you see a scenario involving an unresolved difference on the screen.
Go for it.
Your eyes should immediately scan the multiple choice options for the phrase security count difference account. Unresolved difference equals security count difference account. It is a one-to-one relationship. Tattoo that on your brain.
It is the operational holding pin for the unknown. Mm. And the firm is legally required to put it there because the books and records must accurately reflect all of the firm's assets and liabilities, even the ones they can't currently explain.
So you have to meticulously document your own firm's confusion.
Exactly. Until the discrepancy is investigated and solved.
Okay, so let's track the causality here. Bob logs the daily action in the blotter.
Yeah.
He proves the math at the end of the month with the trial balance. He hunts for discrepancies through reconciliations, and he parks any missing shares in the security account difference account.
That's the flow.
The system is functioning. But doing all of this generates an absolute mountain of documentation.
So much paper.
Which introduces our next massive operational hurdle. What on earth do we do with all of this stuff?
You preserve it.
Just keep it forever.
Well, meticulously. Which brings us to the rule of time. Or the SEC's strict preservation periods.
Because you can't just throw this stuff in a recycling bin when your desk gets full.
Definitely not.
How long does the SEC actually force a firm to hold on to these records?
So this is a heavy memorization area for the exam. But if we break it down logically, you'll see it isn't arbitrary. Preservation is more than just throwing a file in a box. It is keeping the right record for the right duration in the right state of accessibility.
Okay.
Let's look at Kathy's timers. There are four main time categories you need to commit to memory.
Walk me through them. What's number one?
Category one is the six-year rule. This applies to the absolute foundational documents of the firm. Blotters, ledgers, and securities position records.
Okay, 6 years. Let's connect that back to our earlier analogy. The daily ships log the blotter. That is the raw reality of the firm's entire existence.
Yeah.
The regulators demand you hold on to that reality for 6 full years. Why 6 years specifically? Is there a reason?
Because financial fraud, systemic market manipulation, and money laundering schemes often take years to unravel.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. Regulators need a deep enough historical runway to trace a complex scheme back to its absolute origin. 6 years provides a sufficient statute of limitations window for deep forensic auditing.
Makes total sense. Okay, what is category two?
Category two is the three-year rule. This applies to less systemic, more granular transactional records. So things like order memoranda, customer confirmations, and routine correspondence.
Okay, so the individual puzzle pieces?
Exactly.
Like Bob writes down Carl's eccentric spatula order on a memo ticket, executes it, and sends Carl a confirmation receipt. Those specific granular tickets are three-year records.
Exactly. The transaction itself is recorded on the six-year blotter, but the granular piece of paper confirming it to the client, that only needs to be kept for 3 years.
Okay, got it.
Now, category three is where people really get tripped up.
Okay, hit me.
It is 6 years after account closing.
After closing?
Yes. This applies specifically to customer account opening and maintenance records.
Oh, wow. Okay, I want to emphasize how long that actually is in practice because the clock for this retention period does not start when the account is open.
Not at all. It could be decades.
Right. Let's say customer Carl opens his account with Bob in the year 2000.
Okay.
Carl trades with Bob for 25 straight years. Mm-hmm. Bob is required to hold Carl's original account, opening documents, his signed agreements, his updated investment profiles for that entire 25 years.
Yes, the whole time.
The retention clock doesn't even begin ticking until Carl finally gets fed up with Bob's mistakes and transfers his account to another firm in 2025.
Right.
So once the account is officially closed, then the six-year timer starts, meaning Bob is holding that original document from the year 2000 until the year 2031.
It is a massive obligation, but it ensures that if a client claims they were put into unsuitable investments over a multi-decade relationship, the original agreements dictating their risk tolerance are still on file to be examined.
It's basically a time capsule of their relationship.
Exactly.
Okay, and the final category.
Category four is for the life of the enterprise and any successor enterprise.
Life of the firm.
Yep. This applies to organizational documents, partnership agreements, minute books, and broker-dealer registration records.
So like the corporate birth certificate?
That's a good way to put it.
The DNA of the firm's legal existence, that lives forever, even if the firm gets bought out by a successor.
Correct. But, you know, let's look at the physical reality of these rules.
It sounds like a nightmare.
It is. 6 years is a very long time to hold on to a daily blotter. 3 years is a long time to hold on to every single order ticket.
Yeah.
And Bob's desk is already a disaster zone. Does Bob really need to have a paper blotter from 5.5 years ago sitting on his desk, just ready to hand to compliance Kathy the second she asks for it?
I mean, I can't imagine any office functioning like that. It would just be a labyrinth of filing cabinets. You'd never find Bob.
And the SEC actually recognizes that physical limitation. Which brings us to a vital sub-rule you must know.
Okay.
The first 2 years rule.
First 2 years.
Yes. For those 3-year and 6-year transaction records, the blotters, ledgers, order tickets, and confirmations, they must be kept in an easily accessible place for the first 2 years of their respective preservation periods.
Oh, I love this rule because it maps perfectly onto how a real human works.
Right.
For the first 2 years, that blotter is in the filing cabinet right next to Bob's desk.
Yep.
If Kathy asks for it, Bob turns around, opens a drawer, and hands it to her instantly. It is easily accessible. But after 2 years,
it goes away.
It goes into the scary, climate-controlled, off-site storage warehouse where you have to wear a hard hat and sign in with a security guard.
Exactly.
You still possess the record for the full 6 years, but it doesn't have to be instantly reachable after year two.
Exactly. It balances regulatory necessity with operational reality.
Yeah.
But let's throw a wrench into this system.
Let's do it.
What happens when the firm itself decides to call it quits?
Oh, okay, let's do a scenario.
Okay.
Let's introduce Frank the founder.
Good old Frank.
Right. Frank owns the broker-dealer where Bob and Kathy work. Now, Frank is exhausted. He wakes up one morning, looks at the monthly trial balance, sees they are solvent, and says, you know what? I'm done.
He's had enough of Bob.
He's totally had enough. He says, I am formally closing the broker-dealer, withdrawing my registration, buying a one-way ticket to Tahiti, and opening a surf shop.
A beautiful dream for Frank, but an absolute logistical nightmare for Kathy.
Right. So I have a question for you, the listener. Let's pause and prompt here. Frank officially ceases all securities business. The firm's doors are locked. The lights are off. What happens to Frank's preservation duties for all those 6-year blotters and 3-year confirmations? Because the firm is dead, does the regulatory clock just stop?
Think about it.
And take a second. Does he get to throw it all away?
Give him a beat.
It absolutely does not stop.
No, it doesn't. This is a classic, highly testable exam trap. Stopping your securities business does not terminate your preservation duties.
Wow.
The SEC and FINRA still mandate access to those records because client lawsuits, regulatory audits, and fraud investigations often trail years behind a firm's closure.
So Frank cannot just leave the boxes of blotters in the abandoned office building.
No. Frank, or a legally designated successor, is required to maintain each and every record for the remainder of its applicable retention period.
That's wild.
So Frank might be drinking out of a coconut in Tahiti, but he better be paying a third-party archiving service back in New York to securely hold those 6-year ledgers until the clock officially runs out.
The SEC does not care about your tropical retirement, Frank.
Yep.
You owe them the audit trail.
You really do.
Now, Frank is a practical guy. Before he leaves for Tahiti, he realizes he doesn't want to pay monthly warehouse fees to store thousands of cardboard boxes of paper.
Who would?
So he tells Bob, just scan everything, make it all digital, put it on a massive hard drive, and we'll throw out the paper. Which transitions us perfectly into digital storage.
Yes.
Because I know for a fact the SEC does not just let you dump highly sensitive financial ledgers into an editable Microsoft Word document and call it a day.
They absolutely do not. I mean, electronic storage is heavily encouraged today, but the regulators enforce incredibly strict digital safeguards.
They have to.
Right. The electronic system must ensure that the records are instantly viewable, easily downloadable, and perfectly reproducible for regulators upon request. But the most important mandate of digital storage is that it must prevent historical revisionism.
Meaning you can't alter the past to make yourself look better in the present.
Exactly. The rules allow for 2 very specific electronic storage methods. You need to know both. First is the audit trail method.
Okay, so how does that actually function in the real world, like on Bob's computer?
An audit trail system must maintain a complete time-stamped history of any modifications, deletions, or updates to a record.
Okay.
If Bob goes into a digital ledger and changes a client's address or alters a trade amount, the system doesn't just overwrite the O's data.
It saves both.
It captures Bob's logging credentials, the exact millisecond he made the change, what the old data was, and what the new data is.
Oh.
Most importantly, it allows the SEC to perfectly recreate the original record as it existed before Bob touched it.
Okay, so it's a digital paper trail of literally every keystroke. What is the second permitted method?
The second method is the non-rewritable, non-erasable format. You will frequently see this referred to on the exam and in the industry as worm storage.
Like the animal.
Sort of. It stands for write once, read many.
Write once, read many. Worm.
Yes. In a worm system, the record is preserved exclusively in a format that simply cannot be rewritten, overwritten, or erased by anyone.
By anyone.
Not by Bob, not by Kathy, not by Frank, and not by the IT department.
It's locked forever.
Once it is committed to the digital vault, it is immutable.
Okay, let me push back on this, because if I'm Bob, I am going to complain about this incredibly rigid system.
Bob complains about everything.
Of course he does. So let's say Bob is manually typing in a massive order for customer Carl. Carl wants 400 shares. Bob accidentally types 4,000 shares.
Fat finger mistake.
Right. He hits enter. 2 seconds later, Bob realizes he added an extra zero. If the system is worm or heavily auto-trailed, why can't Bob just hit Ctrl plus Z? Wait. Why can't he just backspace, delete the zero, and fix his innocent typo before anyone even sees it? It's a computer. The whole point of digital systems is that we can easily fix our mistakes.
Because an electronic system replaces the physical paper, but it is never allowed to erase the record's history.
But it was just a typo.
Think about the mechanics of fraud, though. If we allow Ctrl plus Z in a financial regulatory framework, the entire system collapses. If Bob can silently erase an innocent typo, Bob can also silently erase a multi-million-dollar crime.
Ah, I see where you're going with this.
Right. A rogue broker could execute an unauthorized trade, siphon off a fraction of a cent from thousands of accounts, realize an auditor is coming, and then just hit Ctrl plus Z to rewrite the history to make it look like the trades never happened.
It goes right back to the crime scene analogy.
It does.
Allowing Ctrl plus Z is like allowing a suspect to mop up their own muddy footprints before the detective arrives, without leaving any trace of the mop or the bucket. If you can alter the scene invisibly, the regulators have zero leverage.
Precisely. So if Bob messes up Carl's order and types 4,000 instead of 400, Bob cannot delete the mistake.
He's stuck with it.
He has to enter a completely new timestamp corrective entry that cancels or amends the first one. Both the original mistake and the subsequent fix have to live side by side in the system forever. You never rewrite financial history. You only add to it.
That makes perfect sense when you look at it through the lens of systemic risk. Now, is there anything else these digital systems require?
Yes, and this is a massive exam trap.
Okay, what is it?
It is not enough that the system is secure. The system must prove to itself that it is secure. This is called automatic verification.
Automatic verification. What is it verifying? Like, what is it doing?
The electronic storage media must automatically verify the completeness and the accuracy of its own storage and retention processes.
So it's auditing itself.
It is a self-checking mechanism. The software has to constantly audit itself to ensure no data is being corrupted or dropped during the archiving process. The exam writers love testing this detail.
I can see why.
If a question asks what an electronic storage system mandates beyond just protected history, you're looking for automatic verification and redundancy.
Redundancy meaning a backup system.
Yes.
Yeah.
You must have a geographically separate backup system so that if your primary server room catches on fire, the 6-year blotters aren't lost to the flames.
Okay, so we have established a highly secure, time-tested framework. We know how to log the trades, reconcile the missing assets, store the paper in a warehouse, or lock it down in a digital worm vault.
We've got the foundation.
Right. But what happens when the human element fails? What happens when Broker Bob gets tired of playing by the rules and decides to take matters into his own hands?
Oh boy.
This brings us to our next critical segment, prohibited conduct. Or, as I like to call it, how Bob gets fired, fined, and barred from the industry.
The rules defining prohibited conduct are just as meticulously detailed as the rules for preservation. Because, as the study material explicitly points out, the exact same record trail that flawlessly supports reconciliations and audits can completely fail if it suffers from inaccurate content, missing details, poor maintenance, or premature loss of access.
It's fragile.
It is. Let's start with the most severe violation. Falsification.
Falsification. I mean, that sounds pretty straightforward. That's Bob taking a literal bottle of whiteout, painting over a ledger entry, and writing in a fake number to hide a massive trading loss.
That is absolutely falsification, yes. But here is the exam trap alert. Do not limit your definition of falsification to the physical or digital alteration of an existing document.
Wait, really?
The fight in our rule is much broader than that. Falsification means creating, altering, or causing a record to be inaccurate.
causing a record to be inaccurate. Okay, let's play that out because I need an example.
Sure.
If Bob is rushing to execute a trade for Carl and Bob just completely makes up a fake account number to put on the ticket because he's too lazy to look up Carl's actual account number.
Classic Bob.
Right, and he's just intending to fix it later when he has more time. Bob didn't alter an existing document. He just created a lazy one. Is that falsification?
It absolutely is. By writing down a fabricated account number, Bob has caused the firm's records to become inaccurate.
Wow.
The overarching rule states that records of transactions must reflect the underlying activity accurately and truthfully. A false entry, or even a deliberately incomplete entry, defeats the entire purpose of having a current book. It poisons the audit trail from the moment of inception.
Okay, I understand malicious falsification, but what if Bob isn't acting with malicious intent? What if Bob is just, you know, overwhelmed and incompetent?
Which is very likely.
Right. This brings us to a highly nuanced distinction you will absolutely be tested on, the difference between improper maintenance and improper retention. These two terms sound incredibly similar, but they are totally different flavors of regulatory violation.
They are structurally distinct. Let's define improper maintenance first. Maintenance issues are errors of creation or upkeep.
Okay.
Improper maintenance means failing to actually make the required records in the first place, failing to keep them current, or failing to include required specific details on a record you did make.
Okay, let me try to build an analogy here so I can remember this. Let's map this onto something physical, like building a bridge.
Okay, I'm listening.
Improper maintenance is Bob being hired to build a bridge, but he simply forgets to install half of the structural bolts. He did some of the work, but he left out required details.
Right.
So the bridge is structurally deficient from the moment it is built. It's an error of creation.
That is an excellent analogy. If Bob forgets to stamp the execution time on an order ticket, he built a bridge missing a bolt. The record exists, but it wasn't maintained to the regulatory standard.
Now, contrast that with improper retention. What is that?
Improper retention is an error of preservation. It means destroying, deleting, concealing, or making a required record inaccessible before the applicable preservation period has officially ended without leaving a legally compliant backup.
Okay, let's go back to the bridge analogy.
Let's do it.
Improper retention is Bob building a perfectly flawless bridge. All the bolts are in place, the engineering is completely sound. But then, 3 years into a 6-year inspection period, Bob intentionally wires the bridge with dynamite and blows it up before the safety inspector arrives.
Exactly.
He destroyed a perfectly good structure prematurely.
Precisely. Or, to tap into the other half of the retention rule, it's like Bob building the perfect bridge, but building a giant impenetrable wall around it so the inspector can't even see if the bridge still exists.
Yes. Oh, that's good. Okay, let's do a pause and prompt on that exact concept.
Get ready.
Because this is a highly specific scenario that tests the limits of the rule. Listener, focus up. Let's say Broker Bob creates a pristine, perfectly compliant daily blotter. He builds the perfect bridge. He doesn't alter the file. He doesn't delete the file. He physically keeps the digital file on his secure hard drive for the full 6-year preservation period.
So far, so good.
But UT, Bob takes that file, encrypts it with military-grade software, and intentionally destroys the password, so that Compliance Kathy and the SEC literally cannot open or read the file ever again.
Oh, Bob.
Is this a regulatory violation? And if so, is it maintenance or retention? Take a beat.
Give them a second to think.
What do you think?
It is absolutely a violation, and it falls squarely under improper retention.
But wait, the file still exists. He didn't delete it. It's on the hard drive.
It doesn't matter that the ones and zeros still physically reside on the hard drive. The rule specifically dictates that if a firm conceals a record, or intentionally makes a record inaccessible before the preservation period concludes, they have failed the retention requirement.
Because they can't get to it.
Right. Retention fundamentally implies usability.
That makes sense. I mean, if you own a DVD of a movie, but you smash the only DVD player on Earth, you don't really have the movie anymore. You just have a useless piece of plastic.
Exactly. And this ties directly back to the operational reality of SEC audits. When a regulator requests a required record, the broker-dealer must promptly furnish a legible, true, complete, and current copy.
Promptly?
Yes. Encrypting a file and throwing away the key makes prompt production impossible, which constitutes a severe retention violation.
Wow. Okay. We have covered a massive amount of ground today.
We really have.
We have traced the architecture of a broker-dealer from the chaotic daily diaries to the complex holding pens of security account difference accounts. We've watched Frank retire to Tahiti only to realize his regulatory obligations followed him.
Poor Frank.
And we've watched Bob try to encrypt his mistakes away. It is time to synthesize all of this into actionable exam knowledge.
To pay off.
We are entering the final sprint. Shake it out, listener. Take a deep breath. We are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways from Function 1. I'm going to throw the concepts out, and our expert is going to hit us with the hard regulatory rule. Let's lock this in. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
Broker Bob needs to log original, itemized, granular activity. Which record is he using?
The blotter. And it must be updated daily. Do not let the exam trick you into substituting a monthly summary.
Frank, the founder, wants to mathematically prove the money balances of the ledger accounts to ensure the firm is solvent.
That is the trial balance, prepared at least monthly.
Bob is doing a reconciliation. The physical vault has 900 shares of a stock. The internal books say the firm should have 902 shares. Bob says, hey, the aggregate totals across all our accounts are close enough. True or false?
False. Dead wrong. That is a massive exam trap. Aggregate totals being close does not satisfy a reconciliation.
Where do Bob's two missing shares have to go?
The unresolved difference must immediately go into the security account difference account for follow-up.
Compliance Kathy is setting her preservation timers. How long must the firm hold on to foundational documents like blotters and ledgers?
6 years.
How long for granular tickets like customer order confirmations?
3 years.
And what is the specific sub-rule for the start of both of those retention periods?
They must be kept in an easily accessible place for the first 2 years.
Frank closes the broker-dealer entirely to move to Tahiti. Can he throw away the firm's historical records since the business is dead?
Absolutely not. Stopping your securities business does not end your preservation duties. You must securely hold them for the remainder of their applicable terms.
The firm wants to go paperless and use an electronic storage system. What are the two acceptable digital formats?
An audit trail method that captures every single modification and deletion, or a non-rewritable, non-erasable worm format.
And what mandatory feature must that digital system possess to constantly check its own integrity?
Automatic verification. It must automatically verify the completeness and accuracy of its own storage processes.
Last one. Bob forgets to put a required timestamp on a customer order ticket. He didn't lie. He just left a box blank. Is this a regulatory violation?
Yes. Improper maintenance covers missing required details. That makes the entry structurally deficient and false by omission.
Boom. That is Function 1. That is the 70% beast of the Series 99, wrestled to the ground and fully unpacked.
You know, before we officially wrap up, I want to offer a final, broader thought for you to chew on as you continue your studies.
Oh, please do.
We have just spent all this time, and the financial industry spends billions of dollars and millions of man hours every year obsessing over keeping records non-rewritable.
Yeah, we really do.
We rely on complex time-stamped audit trails.
Yeah.
And we physically warehouse paper blotters for 6 years just to ensure nobody can cheat the system or alter history.
Right. It is a massive, incredibly expensive, friction-heavy infrastructure of trust.
But think about how this rigid framework collides with the future of finance. We're living in a world that is rapidly iterating toward decentralized ledgers and blockchain technology.
Oh, interesting.
Right. In a true, mature blockchain environment, every single transaction is instantly, mathematically immutable. Uh-huh. It is distributed across thousands of independent nodes simultaneously.
Yeah.
It is, by its very mathematical nature, worm storage. But it achieves that permanence without needing Broker Bob to manually type it, or Compliance Kathy to audit it, or Frank to pay for a warehouse.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that. If the ledger itself is mathematically permanent and public by default, you don't need a regulatory rule threatening Bob not to hit CCRL plus Z, because CCRL plus Z literally does not exist in the architecture of the map.
Exactly. The technology fundamentally solves the human trust problem.
That's fascinating.
So the provocative question you have to ask yourself as a future financial professional is this. Does the very concept of a single broker-dealer's private internal blotter become completely obsolete? In 10 or 20 years, how will the SEC and FINRA regulate a book and record that doesn't live in a filing cabinet or on Frank's private hard drive, but exists everywhere at once on a decentralized network? It completely shatters and rebuilds the paradigm of what books and records even means.
That is a wild thought to leave on. The rules we study today might evolve, the technology will definitely change, but the fundamental need for financial truth never does.
Very well said.
Listener, I want you to keep that in your head as you study. You aren't just memorizing arbitrary time limits. You are learning the underlying architecture of financial truth. Keep grinding, trust the process, and remember, unresolved difference equals security count difference account. Tattoo it on your brain, stay curious, and go absolutely ace that exam.